recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
All right, we've got another minute or so before we get started, but if I could have some help, it looks like we're getting really, really full. So if you've got a seat next to you that isn't occupied, could you raise your hand? And then if you don't mind, you all can come on down and fill in. There's a few seats that are here and there. So come on in, grab a seat. That way you can be comfortable and hear the whole lecture. There's a few more up here as well. While people are moving around, this is a good opportunity as well to turn off cell phones, anything that beeps or makes too much noise. Go ahead and turn that off now. Also, just a quick reminder for the students who are enrolled in Great Decisions. Remember, your paper is due a week from tonight. We won't have a lecture a week from tonight, but your paper is due then, so send that to Corey. Corey will also have the sign-in sheet. Remember, you need to sign in every time so that we know you're here. It's too hard to pick out people's faces when we've got this big a crowd. And we also need you to turn in the paper if you want to get credit for the class. Also, just a reminder, if I know there's a number of high school students here. If you need somebody to sign you in after the lecture, you can come down to me. I'll go ahead and sign you in so that people can ask questions of our speaker tonight. Last little announcement or reminder is that the lecture should go for about an hour, and then we'll have about 20 minutes of question and answer. So we'd ask that you stay for both of those. The question and answer will be a chance for people in the audience to follow up on some things. I'll run around with a microphone, so I ask that you raise your hand for that, and I can come around so that we can all hear what your question is. Again, there's, I think, a couple more seats, maybe one here. If anybody wants to sit down closer, there's two or three empty seats down here. But welcome. It's a pleasure to see you all here tonight. Such a crowded house, and a number of these beautiful red shirts as well from our business students. Welcome to you all. As many of you know, each spring, five speakers are brought to Whitworth's campus to engage the Spokane community with their expertise in current political, cultural, and economic subjects that influence global affairs. It's a testament to Whitworth's commitment to an education that includes people from diverse backgrounds and perspectives that we are able to hear from faculty included in this lineup of speakers, as we will tonight. It is also a testament to our educational commitment that we're able to hear from graduates as well, as our last lecture on May 5th, entitled Humanitarian Aid, A Practitioner's Perspective. We'll be able to hear from a graduate from Whitworth. Great Decisions is coordinated by the Political Science Department, which includes Political Science, Cross-Cultural Studies, Peace Studies, and International Studies majors. And tonight, we're happy to introduce a colleague from the School of Global Commerce and Management at Whitworth. Duff Berquist was named Whitworth's Executive in Residence last fall, bringing 15 years of management experience with the world's top financial institutions. He has spent most of his career working in investment banking in Europe, primarily in Germany and England, while at Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, First Boston, Morgan Stanley, and Lehman Brothers. He studied finance and German at Wirtschaft University in Vienna, earned a bachelor's degree in marketing and German from Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon, and a master's degree in international management with an emphasis in international finance and accounting from the American Graduate School of International Business in Glendale, Arizona. As executive in residence, Berquist works to strengthen Whitworth's connections with local businesses and to provide students with practical insight into emerging business trends and practices. Tonight, he will also provide our community with insights into the largest global economic recession since the Great Depression. This will take us, as his title behind me suggests, from Narvik to Spokane with a stop in Vegas, aboard the Financial Crisis Express. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Berquist to Great Decision.
Wow. I guess I better deliver. Thank you, Patrick, for the introduction. Patrick approached me in this fall and asked me if I would consider speaking in the Great Decisions, and I was honored to be asked. And I think one of the things that I got from this experience was, well, he asked me to come up with the title for the speech. I said, that's fine. So I sat down and thought about what I wanted to talk about and what I wanted to get across, and I came up with my title. I probably will not be asked to actually make up any more titles. It took three pages to come up with my title. But the reason I came up with Narvik to Spokane with a stop in Las Vegas is one of the things I want to express as we think about what happened in 2000, started in 2007, actually started much earlier. But what the result was is, I think most of us are probably Americans in the lecture hall tonight. We think of things from our own basis. We're ethnocentric, sometimes myopic about what does it mean to us as Americans. And what I want us to think about, and one of the title was about, was one of the goals was to it happened across the world. And we have, I'll go into Narvik, but a little town in Norway, and then we'll stop in a few places on our way to Spokane. And in the end, I'll talk a little bit about Spokane, what it means to Spokane. A couple of my, you have to laugh at my jokes. That's a prerequisite, especially for the students in my class tomorrow. I'll ask you to laugh. Some of you will have to be probably old, my age, 45 or older, to get one of them. And then we have Despicable Me. So we have some references to Despicable Me in that, if you've seen that. So the slide behind me, the first couple of slides, what I'd like to do is start our journey and start thinking about what happened. And the top of the slide is you can see Portugal, Ireland, Spain, or Portugal, Ireland, excuse me, and Greece. It's part of the pigs. If you spell it as pig, obviously you've heard of the reference to pigs. It's actually pigs. Portugal, Ireland, Iceland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And why that's important is we think about Greece started the ball rolling last spring with a bank, in the end, a bailout of the EU bailed them out. The euro traded from all the way down to 115 to the dollar. It's back up to 142. So there's a lot of dislocation within the European Union. A lot of talk about breaking up the union, what this means for the EU. And it's continued with Ireland. It was happening at the same time, bailout of Ireland. And then Portugal just last week asked for a EU bailout. And what does this mean? It means austerity for these countries. It means pain, suffering for the people to go through, cutting benefits. The companies below it are all a result of what happened. If you look at Bear Stearns, part of got the ball rolling with when their hedge funds collapsed in June of 2007. Fannie Mae, which is a ward of the state, so Fannie and Freddie are government-sponsored enterprises that are now being run by the government. Countrywide, Washington Mutual, Lehman Brothers, obviously, the largest financial bankruptcy in the U.S. history. And the last one's Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch is owned by B of A. So of the five major investment banks that were involved in the markets in before 2007, two of them are left. They're not standalone investment banks anymore. Investment banks, they're now regulated by the Fed. They're bank holding companies. And we'll go into the reasons why they are their holding companies. As we think about the crisis, we think about these all represent countries. Obviously, we know what the eagle represents. Spending 10 years in England, I became a soccer fan. Not that I thought I was going to be a soccer fan before I got there, but if you want to have a conversation with anybody in your office while you're working in London, you better become a soccer fan. So I chose the Gunners, which are Arsenal. And stands for the UK. In the UK, if you think about what happened in the UK, similar to what's happening in the US, they didn't have to the degree. But this is the second time it's happened in the last 20 years. If you bought a house in 1990 in England, it took you 10 years to actually get back to even. 3 years later, you start the process again. And again, people who bought in the middle of 2004, 2005 are underwater. As we come down to the left-hand corner, Spain. Spain is very similar to the U.S. Again, not in size, part of the pigs. One of the reasons it is part of the pigs is what happened within their market. Now, as I was doing some research on that, I found a quote by the Spaniards. And what the Spaniards say about the decade from 95 or 97 through 2007. What they call that is when we thought we were rich. So the amount of money that poured into the real estate sector over that 10-year period drove the economy, drove the market up. Some of the facts around Spain. The $560 billion that are the loans that are related to real estate, around $250 billion of those are impaired. The Bank of Spain just came out with a report saying that 5.7% or 5.6% of the loans, the total loan portfolio, are non-performing loans. Market experts think this is way too low. If you think about the degree of investment within Spain, at the height of the crisis in 2007, 800,000 housing units were built. Today, 1.5 million housing units are empty. So you think of the drain of the economy. Spain has one of the highest unemployment rates in Europe at 20%. So at some point in time, you pay the piper. The last one is in the ocean is in Dubai. During the height of the housing boom, 70% of the building cranes were in the United Emirates in Dubai. They have the largest indoor ski hill in the world. I don't know why they need it in Dubai, but they have the ski hill in Dubai. This is called the Palm. It was built out of reclaimed land from the ocean. It was obviously, it's very popular. You have a lot of A-list celebrities that actually bought property here. When I was working in London, I had a lot of people that I worked with buying basically off the plan housing or apartments in Dubai. So again, we start thinking about, it wasn't a U.S. phenomenon. Did the U.S. have a huge impact on the crisis? Yes, they did. But we just mentioned three other countries that had a very similar path the U.S. did. You notice that we stopped going east. We stopped in Dubai. Asia had their own crisis in 1998. I think they learned a lot from that. And it's interesting to note, one of the smartest hedge funds, and he's a short seller, which means he sells securities that he thinks are going down. He is short China. And why he is short China, he thinks that's the biggest housing bubble that we've seen in a long time, bigger than the U.S. He says that maybe 40-50% of their economy is tied in some way to the real estate or building markets, or the GDP. So again, as we think about that, it was not only a U.S. phenomenon. As we go through the presentation, there's one thing that I want us to think about. And Simon Murphy was a classic. He ran one of the social clubs for the developments in Dubai. And I think this quote that he has is typifies what happens in bubbles, and you'll see it throughout the presentation. As they say, eagles fly high with eagles. The motivating factor to come here is greed. You have to be selfish, have minimal social responsibility, and want to make money quick. Brits in Dubai are gamblers. It's the nature of the beast. Not everyone wins. If you think about what happened over the last 2 years, 3 years, this typifies people's involvement in housing, buying apartments, very little done. A lot of that was down to greed. Narvik, beautiful, beautiful town. It's an open water bay. It's north of the Arctic Circle. Germans and the Norwegians and the Brits fought over it in World War II. It's very close to the iron ore mines in Sweden. How did Narvik get to be part of the financial crisis? If we look at where it is, it's quite a ways north of the Arctic Circle. It's a town of 18,000 people. It has a budget of $160 million a year. And this was just going on when I left London, and it intrigued me. How did this community get in trouble? So you have a community of 18,000 people. A lot of their revenue comes from the hydroelectric plant that produces revenue or produces energy, and that's their revenue stream for their community. This community had been investing their money, that revenue stream, in securities, conservative securities. As we saw a lot, as mentioned by Simon, the city council decided that they weren't earning enough revenue, that they would like to increase their revenue on their investments. So what did they do? They contacted their broker, which is Terra Securities. I don't know the conversation, but they ended up actually buying what they call FLNs, which are fund-linked notes. Citibank was the bank that designed these. And what a fund linked note is, basically, is a derivative on a fund. And what they decided to invest in was the spread between a municipal yield and LIBOR. And LIBOR is a London interbank offered rate. It's where the banks lend each other money. As long as the market stays stable, that will generate yields and give you a better return than a very conservative investment. This is a product that's a fairly sophisticated product. This is what LCT, or long-term capital management, was doing in 1998 with the Nobel Prize winners that they blew themselves up and put the financial market on the brink of collapse. They need to be rescued. So we see a very small community north of the Arctic Circle invest in something that potentially they don't know the risk of that product. They ended up, and when we think about the magnitude of this, they budget's $160 million. They ended up losing $35 million. What happened? They had to cut services. And not only did they decide to invest in these FLNs, they took a loan out against future revenues from the dam, the hydroelectric plant. So they used leverage to invest in a risk investment. It's one of the core themes that I think, to me, is very important. They misjudged, and we'll talk about it in the later slides, the risk that they took and the reward that they received. So they were what they call chasing yield. They pushed out paid more for the risk than the return they received. Within this community, there's seven other communities. The total amount was 33,000 people that represented. They lost a total of $90 million. Again, this was, to me, the epitome of what happened in the financial crisis. One of them, they misjudged risk. They weren't greedy. They were greed because they wanted to generate more money, but they misjudged the risk that they took. So that's our first stop. Second stop is, I didn't put it on there, but this is where I worked for, this is Lehman Brothers. Right next to it's Morgan Stanley. This is where I worked for 4 years. Picture of the Right Honorable Gordon Brown, dedicated the building in 2004. At that point in time, he was the head of the Bank of England, Exchequer, became Prime Minister. The funny thing about this is the guys with the right glove, it's either Christie's or Sotheby's, they're auctioning this off in London after the bankruptcy. Okay, this is where you need to think about Despicable Me. This used to be my boss, obviously a couple levels obviously above me. But Dick Fuld, he's the CEO of Lehman Brothers. He's very well respected within the industry, not liked. He's a very tough businessman. He brought us Lehman Brothers out of the merger with American Express, lived through the financial crisis, the sovereign debt crisis, default in Russia, and the Asian crisis, and basically said to the firm, that'll never happen to us again. They had a liquidity problem. They survived. He did a very good job within the firm of taking Lehman and transferring and building it into an investment bank that had a lot of scope, wasn't relying totally on fixed income. They diversified at that point in time in 2007. Over 50% of the revenue was generated outside of the U.S., which was a goal. What he didn't do was take care of the firm. As a CEO, what is your responsibility? Is to take care of the firm. In 2007, he made a comment, and I wasn't there. I was talking to my colleagues, and I was here. He said, it's about taking care of the mothership, withdrawing into the market, make sure taking risk off. Actually, he did that for a while. Lehman actually increased the amount of assets they had on their books in 2008. So I came to the conclusion, a little bit upset with how Dick handled himself, and I came to the conclusion he had his alter ego. Gru. So anybody that's seen Despicable Me knows that Gru, his goal in life was to be the best villain. And he worked very hard at becoming a villain. So he was, in Dick's spare time, he was hanging out with the minions figuring out how to be a villain. What got a lot of play in Despicable Me was the Bank of Evil, right? Former Lehman Brothers. So Dick must have been hanging out in the Bank of Evil. So if we have the Bank of Evil, if Lehman Brothers, as we say, Lehman Brothers is the Bank of Evil, the Bank of Evil had a few of evil siblings. Again, soccer reference, that's Wayne Rooney. He's a striker for Man U. It's amazing what they do on the internet now as far as changing things. AIG used to sponsor Man U. AIG, when I say we, we've invested $180 billion in AIG. Some of the students haven't paid taxes, but all the taxpayers, we own AIG. We must like them a lot. We spent $180 billion on them. So that's what we've spent so far on AIG. The other two wards of the state are Fannie and Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So they are basically the underwriters of the mortgage market. We like them a lot, too. So far, we've invested about $150 billion in Fannie and Freddie. Equity has been wiped out. What the government said was basically equity holders of Fannie and Freddie receive zero. The bond holders will give you 100%, because what the name government-sponsored enterprise means is that the investors believed that was government debt. So anybody that held the bonds of Fred and Fannie were paid in full and still are. CBO did an estimate on Freddie and Fannie, saying that in the best case scenario, it'll probably cost us, taxpayers, a little around $210 billion. Worst case scenario is upwards to $350 billion. That's over the next decade. So what I want to do is start talking about the root cause of what happened. And the first stop we have to, first place we'll stop is the capital structure. How a firm finances itself. So if you look in the balance sheet, on the left-hand side of the balance sheet, you have assets. On the right-hand side, you have basically how the firm finances those assets. Assets minus liabilities gives you equity, total equity. So within the firm, and as we rolled up into 2007, or the difference between financing on a long-term basis and a short-term basis is fairly significant. If you look at where the 10-year Treasury is trading at today, the 10-year Treasury is trading at around 3.5%, so 350 basis points. The 3-month Treasury bills are trading at 30 basis points. So the difference between short-term and long-term financing is 320 basis points, if my math is correct. That's a significant portion. That's a significant amount if you're on your financing. So that being said, firms would rather finance themselves on a short-term basis due to cost savings. What does this mean is during that period, a lot of their assets were financed on a short-term basis. The other option was equity, and equity wasn't used. Equity, you give up ownership on it. You also, we'll talk about it later, it hurts your ROE. The height of right before things went south, Bear Stearns was borrowing up to $70 billion overnight. $70 billion overnight. So the overnight people they were borrowing from what they call repos, and those repos are basically transactions with other banks, or they're borrowing through the interbank market. That's where they borrow LIBOR. And why is this important? What happened in 2008, September 2008, that short-term credit market closed down. So how they financed themselves. So all these banks, and it was not just Bear Stearns, it was Lehman, it was Goldman, it was Morgan Stanley, were financing themselves on a short-term basis. That closed down. There was, obviously, it provided that caused a great deal of panic. The Fed stepped in. And this is when Morgan Stanley and Goldman switched to bank holding companies. Why did they do that? They switched to the bank holding companies so they could borrow at the discount window. So the Federal Reserve, became the borrower of last resort. And as we think about this, it's very interesting. If you have a foreign bank has a subsidiary in the U.S., by law, they can borrow at the discount window. Right? At the height of the borrowing in October of 2008, overnight lending on that one night was $111 billion. Of that $111 billion, 70% was from foreign banks. So as we think about that, the Fed was financing the rest of the world, and that was mainly European banks. Dexia was one of the largest holders. So again, if you think about capital structure, how the firms set themselves up basically gave them exposure to that being shut down. Understanding leverage. So you have your capital structure, and what does leverage do to you? Again, the use of leverage, if you think of the balance sheet, left-hand side of the balance sheet, how do investment banks or firms grow their business? Well, they borrow and buy assets. And most of this asset was funded on a short-term basis. If you look at the leverage ratios that you hear, there's 35-1. And what that means is for $1 of equity, they're financing a certain amount of assets. And that's financed by basically debt. If you look at in 2007, most of the major financial or investment banks were running leverages of 35 to 1, upwards to 40 to 1. And if we just do a calculation there, if we think about what that means, so Lehman at that point in time, before things started going south, had a equity base of $40 billion. If we multiply that by their leverage ratio, we get up to, they could have assets of $1.4 trillion. The problem with that issue is, if they have a bad day in the market trades down 3%, which equates to a loss of $42 billion, they're technically insolvent. Assets are less than liabilities. It wipes out the equity. So the risk that these investment banks were taking with that high leverage, they expose themselves to the market. If we think that's bad, we should check out the evil siblings, Fannie and Freddie. They're learning leverage ratios of 75 to 1. And they have a fairly highly correlated portfolio. They don't have a lot of other business lines outside of mortgages. So when we think about that, the whole system was leveraging themselves up to having a perfect market and that market continuing to be the way it was. We, as individuals, didn't get away with not having any responsibility. In the U.S., our mortgage debt increased from 2001 to 2007 by 63%, with basically flat earnings. How does that happen? Now, you hear a very common phrase now is using your house as an ATM. So what people did is they refinanced. They took money out of their house. If you had 80% equity in your house, house value goes up, equity increases, you refinanced your house and took 60% of the equity out. Maybe now you only had 20 or 30% equity in the house. Market housing prices fall by 35%, you're underwater. So I think if you look at the from the investment banks to Fannie and Freddie to individuals, we all, in the end of 2007, as we came into 2007, there's a huge amount of leverage in the system. We didn't have a lot of flexibility, either from a corporation point of view or an individual point of view. And I think if you look at the graph, you can graphically see what happened. If you look at the spike in 2001, we increased our debt, our mortgage debt went from 42% all the way up to 70%. Total debt, if you add up mortgage debt and consumer debt, as a percentage of GDP, we almost hit 100%. So again, we have responsibility. We leveraged ourselves as individuals. We were as guilty as some of the institutions as far as the risks we were taking. Corporate results, shareholders, why are they important in this whole process? ROE. ROE is what the investment banks and a lot of the firms compare themselves to. I remember sitting in London in 2006, quarterly earnings didn't come out. We were comparing our ROE against Goldman Sachs. Our benchmark was Goldman Sachs. How do you generate ROE? Well, you generate more if you look at the numerator and denominator. Either you cut equity, which buying back shares, which you could do, or you increase net income. On the basic formula of ROE, one thing's missing. There's no debt calculation there. So if you take on more debt, use leverage, as we talked about, leverage your capital structure, use more leverage to create more assets, to generate more net income, your ROE goes up. So there was a race to continue to generate higher and higher ROE, which again was symptomatic of the environment that we were in at that point in time. Compensation, another thing we looked at is it's been a hot topic, is compensation. Compensation payout, and this is another thing we looked at when our quarterly earnings came out, what is the compensation payout ratio? And what does that mean? Investment banks were paying out about 50% of their net revenue in compensation. So very important for people who work there, what's your compensation ratio look like? Compensation ratio by division. Was it compensation a cause of the financial crisis? I would say no. Did it help people take risks that potentially they wouldn't take otherwise? Yes. So I think it does have some play in the crisis. I don't think you can't blame the whole crisis on compensation. I had a side and I took it out. But I went today, when I was doing the research on this, I went and searched on who are the highest paid individuals. I looked at the banks. Top of the list was Tiger, Mickelson, LeBron, Ben Stiller, and Johnny Depp, from 90 million down to 50 million. Financial executives have started about 23 with J.P. Morgan, Diamond from J.P. Morgan. But compensation, it's interesting because we're starting to talk about there should be a lot of deferred compensation. If you were working in an investment bank in 2007 and you were a managing director, between 55 and 65% of your compensation was deferred. And that deferred was from 1 to 5 years. So that was already in place. The clawback issue is new, and I think that it's good. Basically, what clawback says, if you lose money, if you had a great year, you don't get all that money. If you lose money the next year, they take some of that revenue back, income back. So the meat of what you hear a lot about in the financial crisis, securitization and CDS. The process of securitization is fundamental to the housing market. And what securitization is we take the bonds or the loans, we bundle them together into securities, and we sell them to investors. By doing this, what we've done is we've allowed the banks that wrote the loans to clear their balance sheets. And we provided a security, a stable security, depending on how, if you pay your loan back or not, that investors want to buy. Without the securitization market, it basically shuts down the housing market. And the reason for that being is if a bank cannot clear their loans that they write, they are limited by the amount of loans that they write by the capital they have. So what securitization does, it opens up the pool of capital for the housing market. CDOs are the next step, the next iteration in the securitization process. And what CDOs did during the middle 2000s was there's three different tranches in mortgages. It's what they call prime, which is the highest quality. If you have a high credit rate, you can qualify as a prime borrower. The middle section is called Alt-A, and the ones with the lowest credit ratings, credit scores, are subprime. And what CDOs did is we wrapped these three together, created security, and sold it out to individuals with different payout structures. So if you look at securitization, where we started with normal securitization, we moved into CDOs. We'll talk about CDOs a little later, but CDOs is one of the issues, the main drivers of the crisis. Derivatives. You hear a lot about derivatives. Derivatives are bad, derivatives are good. Key question first is what it's listed and what's OTC. The difference and the defining factor of listed is a derivative security is just like a stock of IBM. It trades on an exchange. You really don't have counterparty risk because it's settled through an exchange. An exchange monitors your margin. If you have an issue with that trade, they will automatically liquidate the position. So a listed security or derivative is a derivative that trades on the exchange. Why is that important? It allows us, if you're a regulator or the market, to see on a daily basis, if you snap the door shut today on a listed option on IBM, you could tell how many contracts were open on that security. So again, as a business or risk manager, as a regulator, you could see what type of risk is in that system. OTC, on the other hand, is over-the-counter. And an OTC security or derivative is negotiated between two counterparts. So you have Bank A and Bank B. They write a contract with the details of what they both have to perform. It is between two banks. Why is that an issue? First of all, it's opaque. You really don't know what leverage or what exposure the market has to each other. We hear contagion. If Bank A writes to Bank B and Bank B does a contract with Bank C and Bank B fails, we have a lot of counterpart risk. And talk about contagion, that's exactly what they're talking about, is potentially the impact it has on all these banks. So we get to CDS. Well, let's talk about the listed value. We were talking about this in one of the finance classes last fall. The total value of all OTC and listed derivatives, and this is from last year, was close to a quadrillion. Say that word a couple of times, quadrillion. Think about that, quadrillion. I was having a hard time saying trillion, and now I'm saying quadrillion. And that is most of those derivatives are listed on fixed income products. And why? Now, there is a reason the Chinese own $1 trillion worth of our debt. It's the only place they can buy $1 trillion worth of debt. Very liquid market. What that means is you have a lot more exposure, a lot more derivatives contracts outstanding. So CDS. CDS is, again, here two things, two terms linked to the financial crisis normally, CDOs and CDSs. CDS is what they call a credit default spread. They just started writing these credit default spreads in the mid-2000s. And it's a swap, credit default swap. And what you're doing is you're swapping default risk for a premium. AIG was in this business. AIG shouldn't be in this business. AIG wrote $80 billion worth of credit default swaps. And what writing means is they would trade with Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs would say, I'd like to buy credit default swaps on Lehman. AIG would write them a contract, get premium. The problem is if the bank goes bankrupt and defaults, they owe them the face value of the bond. So it's insurance policy. And what AIG's problem was, they were writing a lot of CDS contracts because the credit rating agencies would rate CDOs, rated them AAA. It's not an excuse for AIG. They should have done a lot more due diligence. But their view is if it's rated AAA, like a treasury, there's very low default risk, and the premium we do have will cover the product. So if you look at what happened in 2008, September 4th, 2008, back to 2007, the outstanding value was $60 trillion of notional value in 2007. Today it's around $40 trillion. But if we look back to September 14th, 2008, the CDS, and it's quoted as a percentage of the amount you insured. So if we just take the example of Lehman CDS on September 4th, the close of business on September 14th, 2008, they declared bankruptcy on Monday morning, the 17th, was trading at 600 basis points. So for $1,000, if you just use a $1,000 bond, for $60, you could buy protection on $1,000 worth of Lehman bonds. On Monday morning, you made $940 on your trade. Merrill, on the other hand, at the same point in time, was trading at 400 basis points. And what it tells, what the credit default swap should tell us, is the likelihood and how we started using them and how the investment banks were using them, what is the likelihood of default? If you look at Greece, their five-year spread, record spread, of 1,000, over 1,000 basis points. And what is that telling us? It's telling us the market thinks there's a very high likelihood that Greece is going to restructure their debt. Portugal is trading around 550. The rest of the pigs have traded down. They were up around 400 or 500 basis points. Spain and Italy have actually come back into around 200 basis points. It raises the question, where's the U.S. at? Does the U.S. have any credit risk? So the 10-year Treasury traded up in March, into March, to the contract traded up to a high, 68 basis points. What does that tell us? It's a lot lower than Greece. It's a lot lower than Portugal. But the point is, it's the highest it's been. So the market's telling us that the likelihood of default is going up in the U.S., related to the disagreements about potentially defaulting on the debt that the Congress is having it. But as we track this has become important as we think about how our debt trades. This is where you're going to have to actually be able to 45 to get this. So the question I hear a lot in the market, and you hear CEO after CEO come up and say, we didn't know this was going to happen. We had no idea. In a reference to that, thanks, guys.
I know nothing.
I told you, you had to be 45. That's Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes, right? I told you, you had to laugh at joke. You had to be 45. I entertained myself at home today. I played that about five times, six times around. My daughter walked in. She thought that was pretty funny. But what did they know? I think what the correct answer is, we didn't think it would be this bad. And we'll talk about the why it was so bad. But we had an inkling in equity trading that the consumer, and we kept betting, or we had a prop trader that kept betting against it, and he kept losing money. He finally made money. But if you looked at that graph we showed you about the U.S. consumer, or the U.S. individual, the percentage of debt, the debt they were carrying, they had to collapse at some point in time. So our second stop is leaving Las Vegas. And why did I choose this? And as I thought about the whole situation in the U.S., there's three areas that actually epitomized the greed, a bubble. Florida, Arizona, and Las Vegas. So my question was, I was going to put in Sheryl Crow in here, but I'm not smart enough to figure out how to get an audio clip in here outside of, I found Sergeant Schultz. But leaving Las Vegas, and I came up with the idea, not likely. So I pulled a couple of quotes in here, not likely why. What drove the investment in Las Vegas? Obviously, you had a huge increase in house values over a 2 or 3 year period. What was the result? This is taken from 2010. Las Vegas had the number one default rate in the U.S. One out of 28 ever households are foreclosed. National average of 128. This is a quote from on a real estate broker's website, posted in January 2011, basically saying that if you're reading this, you might be one of the two-thirds of the people that are underwater in their mortgage. Remember when we talked about refinancing? That's one way to get underweight and your house falls, or you just bought and you're underwater. The problem with that is, that more than half or substantially underwater, more than 50% underwater. And the problem within a lot of these areas is you can't get financing. There's a lot of houses on the market. Prices continue to fall. So if you own a house in Las Vegas, you're probably not going anywhere. Or you, what's been popular and you hear it now, is strategic defaults, which is basically walking away from your house. So the students have taken my finance class, or should be fairly familiar with this. It's a basic tenet of, we'll test you on it tomorrow. It's a basic tenet of finance. It's called the security market line, and it's a basis for capital asset pricing model. What does it tell us? And this is, if you relate this to Narvik, this is exactly what happened in Narvik. This is what exactly happened to a lot of people that misjudged the risk. And what the line tells you is it's a relationship between the risk you take and the return that you should get. In this case, if we put a couple people up there, you want to be on point A. That means you're above the security market line. The return that you're receiving is much greater than the risk you're taking. If you ever find that spot, you want to back up the truck and buy as much as you can in that security. Where is Narvik at? Narvik's down here in B. Right? The amount they stretch for yield, the amount of risk that they took, they weren't compensated by the amount of return that they received. Fundamental in, for me, in a crisis, a lot of people made this decision across the board. They weren't being compensated for the risks they took. If you look at what Bill Gross, fund manager for PIMCO, it's one of the largest fixed income investors in the world. Buffett, we know who Buffett is. They both came out in the last 2 or 3 weeks basically saying that U.S. Treasuries, you are not being compensated for the amount of risk that you're taking if you buy U.S. Treasuries today. What are they basically saying? They're basically saying U.S. Treasuries are at B. And they're saying is that the price is going to drop and the yield's going to go up. What does that mean to us? For all of America, it's going to cost us more to finance our debt. But for me, this is very fundamental to what happened. Classic example with being Narvik. As we sat in London, and we had this discussion a lot, and what this chart shows you, and there's a great quote, is excessive yield is causing people to lose their risk aversion. What does that mean? It means that people, as the liquidity comes into the market, people are chasing products to invest in. And what the graph shows you, the red line is high yield. Another name for high yield is junk bonds. They used to call it junk bonds, and they came up with a more political correct name. They call it high yield now. It is bonds that had a much higher risk of default, lower rated bonds. The blue line is the difference between, so the red line is the difference between high yield bonds and treasuries, and the blue is corporates and treasury. And why is this important? What happened, if you can see what happened in 2007, that line traded, the red line traded, the spread traded down to about 200 basis points. And so people were making the decision that junk bonds, you should only, the return you should get is only 200 basis points more than U.S. Treasuries. And think about that. A triple rated U.S. Treasury, risk-free instrument, you're only being compensated 200 more basis points to take that risk. Risk is mispriced. This is what Narvik did. This is a type of trade that the fund-linked note for Narvik, this is what they were investing in. As long as things are normal and there's no disruption in the market, things work well. What happened in the summer of 2007 when the Bear Stearns hedge funds collapsed? The spread blew open. It traded from 200 basis points up to 2,000 basis points. If you look at the blurb, the hiccup in 2000 or 1998, that was basically LTCM and all the Nobel Peace Prize winners blowing themselves up. So you look at, again, you look at the security market line, you look at stretching for yield. For me, this is a very important part of the crisis. Black Swan. There's a very good quote. Nassim Taleb wrote this book before the crisis, and you see him on talk show hosts. The definition of black swan is an outlier, an event that lies beyond the realm of normal expectations. Most people expect all swans to be white because that's what their experience tells them. A black swan is, by definition, a surprise. Added that to Francis Bacon, assuming more order than exists in chaotic nature. They shouldn't let me play with PowerPoints. What does that tell us? Why is that important? If you look at a black swan, if you look at VAR, I have VAR up too. VAR is a statistical analysis of the amount of money a firm can lose on a single trading day. And there's two sections on VAR. You can use a two-standard deviation confidence interval or a three-standard deviation. So what it does, it picks up 95% of the outcomes or 99%. And all investment banks still today present that as one of their risk measures. What happened when you have a black swan event and you have a six-standard deviation event or a 10-standard deviation event? If you look at the bell curve, it's a tail, what they call tail risk. What happens when that occurs? If you look at the risk management sections of investment banks, we're very sophisticated. We had risk managers on the floor monitoring our positions. If we were breaking a limit or if we were taking too much risk in a certain security, they would come over. They stress test our positions. And stress testing means they take our positions in our balance sheet and they run them through scenarios where we had market dislocations. So we look at the 1987 crash. We look at the Russian and the Asian crisis in 1998. We look at the dot-com. And most of these stress tests lasted 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They didn't model for an event where the short-term financing dried up. That actually, instead of lasting 2 or 3 weeks that they modeled for, it lasted 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. So my point is that we as a financial investment community didn't look at what Taleb says or what Bacon says. We tried to put too much order into the market. 100-year events, if you look at the 100-year events, they keep happening every 2 or 3 years. Does that mean we're not going to have another 100-year event for 3,000 years? Or are 100-year events more common than we think? If you look at one of the reasons that of the financial crisis, they didn't, if you're running a 35-to-1 leverage ratio and one of these things happens, you might as well just take your key, throw your key away and walk out the door because it's over. And again, I think for me is how do you manage this. It's very tough to manage a process like this because it costs you a lot of money. If you look at the nuclear disaster in Japan, you could apply their stress or their analysis. How much does it cost you to make sure that that will withstand? It withstand a 9.0 earthquake, but did they think about the tsunami? So what happened? You don't hear it mentioned much, but I think the basis started 9/11. You had the dot-com blow up and collapse in 2000, and you had 9/11 happen. Weakened the economy. Economy was trying to find its feet. We loosened the money supply. So I think one of the drivers was 9/11. Non-traditional mortgages. And if you're interested, there's the Congress put out, the Financial Commission put out their reasons why they think what happened. And being political, they had Republicans and Democrats that couldn't come up with what they all agreed on, which is typical. You had one view that came out, and then you had two dissenting views. And the dissenting views were Republicans. And the dissenting view, one of their big points was non-traditional mortgages. And non-traditional mortgages are what we talked about, the subprime and Alt-A. In 2007, between 25 and 27, depending what numbers you take, million of the 55 million mortgages were written were non-traditional mortgages. And why is that important? The default rate in 2006 and 2007 on subprime mortgages was 20.6% and 21.5% respectively. For prime mortgages, it was 4.2% and 4.8%. So again, a significant difference between that. And the leverage you have if you're writing securities, CDOs, has a marked impact on the performance. If you think about what a CDO is, if you default on your payment, the price of that security falls. Lending standards. As the demand for these CDOs went up, what happened? Mortgage brokers, Fannie Mae, Countrywide, decreased their lending standards. So what allowed them to happen is liar loans, no doc loans. Why? It's a chicken and egg. The investors on the other end wanted this product. The only way to get this product was to basically loosen standards. Easy money goes along with the Fed basically running a monetary policy, low interest rate policy. One of the other dissenting views, one of his views was a credit bubble. What is a credit bubble? You had a ton of money coming into the U.S. Why was money coming into the U.S.? Better investment returns. Housing bubble we talked about. Credit ratings and securitization. For me, this is, again, one of the, as we talked about the global, thinking about global, this is one of the drivers for me. There is most private and public pension funds, governments, have a clause in their chart that says they can only invest in AAA rated securities. Why? It protects the people's pension. So they're supposed to be investing in low-risk securities. What happened when the credit rating agencies rated these AAA? It greatly expanded the investment pool for these securities. And if you are a pension fund manager and all of a sudden you see a product comes out that's yielding 3% over your other securities and it's AAA rated, you might not do your due diligence. And I say that's a great investment for us. So what you had is a explosion of the investment opportunities. That's why UBS almost went bankrupt. You had the German Landesbanken, which are state-owned banks, going bankrupt, very conservative banks. You had the investment banks that, well, different communities across Europe and Asia were investing in these projects that were AAA. Conservative banks took the risk. So for me, the credit rating agencies have a lot of responsibility with regard to allowing this product to multiply. Financial institutions. If we look at the financial institutions, correlated risk positions and concentration, risk of contagion. A correlated risk position is a position that you have on your balance sheet or a number of positions that move in the same direction. Why is this important? If you have a very high degree of correlated risk position when the market trades down, as prices started to stabilize and fall, you have an issue with your balance sheet. The risk of contagion, the concentration. If you look at the market, they were concentrated bets. Fannie Mae. Think about Fannie Mae and Freddie. Running a 75-to-1 leverage ratio, had a very high correlated position. They invest in mortgages. Again, what happened, the contagion part of it, OTCs, if you look at what happened with AIG, it was a pass-through. They invested they wrote the credit default swaps. They go bankrupt. The risk of them, and that's why if you look why we like AIG so much, they said to AIG to stop the contagion effect. Shock and panic, we know what happened. Economic crisis ensues. Great. I'll refer you to Simon from the Brit that was working in Dubai's quote at the beginning. I asked this question to one of the money banking class, who's responsible? We have to find somebody to blame, right? We like to put fingers on somebody. Greenspan. Why do I say Greenspan? Well, he's in charge of the Fed at the point where we're running an easy monetary policy. U.S. government, 1992 Housing and Community Act. Very noble act, signed in the law by President Bush, older President Bush, supported by Clinton, supported by Bush. What they were trying to do is to create affordable housing. They decreased the lending standards. It begs the question, should everybody own a house? Yes, you should own a house if you can afford it. Individuals, we can't escape it. We were responsible. We ran our debt up to almost 100% of GDP. Regulators, how can we allow investment banks to run a 35-41 leverage ratio, or a government-sponsored entity to run a 75-to-1. So regulation, and they've addressed some of that. Regulators had a part of the front. So it was talked about banks and financial institutions, couldn't happen without them. Credit rating agencies, again, couldn't happen without them. I think these guys escape some blame in the press. A mortgage broker at that point in time had no skin in the game. And what I mean by that, they were paid by commission. They wrote loans, went on to the next one. So their motivation was to write as many of these loans as possible. They didn't really care if you paid it back. Appraisers, they got paid by making sure that you could qualify for your house. Real estate brokers, they wanted to get into that house. Whatever it took, they put pressure on appraisers. Real estate profession has a part to play in this. Investors. I often think about when they blame everybody, and investors are blaming the banks for selling the product. When we go out and buy something, if we go out and buy a used car and we don't have it inspected, whose fault is that? Is that the guy that wanted to sell us a lemon, or is that our fault for not doing the due diligence and figuring out if that car could run or not? Investors can't escape blame. A lot of these guys didn't do due diligence. How much due diligence do you think that the city council in Narvik did, or did they trust their brokers, Terra Securities? And is that an excuse to trust your broker? Last stop, Spokane. When I first moved back to Spokane, if you watched a public station or a local station, Sterling Savings Bank was on the ads constantly. We're not doing what the other bank's doing. We're a safe harbor. You can trust us. In 2005, non-performing assets on their books were $10 million. The end of 2009, it was almost $950 million, close to 10% of their assets, a huge amount. So in December of 2009, the FDIC was going to close them down. They had to raise capital. Fortunately for Sterling, they did raise capital. You had two private equity firms, Thomas Lee and Orbert Pincus, that invested, I think it was like $400 million to bring their capital ratios up to the par. So what does it tell us? How did Sterling get in trouble? Where did their losses come from? Developers in real estate in Portland, Southwest Washington. So again, you have the same type of exposure that brought down large banks in Sterling. Spokane, as we think about Spokane, what impact it has in Spokane. Employment rate in Spokane has gone up the last 5 months. It's 10.6%, higher than the national average. As the nation's recovering, Spokane's going the other way. It's higher than the state. What does that tell us? It tells you that from an economic point of view, we're not recovering. We're still suffering from what happened in the financial and economic crisis. I called a broker and was talking about homes. Can you glean anything from the housing market here? And if you look at it, there's 3,100 homes in the Spokane area. Of that, in the under 200K homes where a lot of the activity is going on, you have an 11-month supply. In the 2007 numbers, I extrapolated a little bit on the sales, roughly around four to 6 months. The interesting thing is when you look at the homes above $600,000, you have a 5.5-year supply today versus in 2007 around 12 to 15 months. And I was thinking about this. Why? Is it because people leveraged themselves up to buy a bigger house? Things changed. They can no longer afford that house. If you're looking at the same thing, if you own a $600,000 house, you're probably not going there. You're stuck in Spokane. So the impact on Spokane obviously is significant, and we're not recovering as fast as the rest of the nation is. I just want to do a couple of things. Remember I talked about the 100-year events. We've had a lot of bubbles. We had real estate. We had .com. We had a Japanese. It says lost decade up there. It should say lost two decades. They're still recovering. So we've had three large events in the last 20 years. You could say 100-year events. I just wanted to point out what drives bubbles. Great quote from Gordon Gekko from Wall Street. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Think about Simon from Dubai. I would hazard to guess if you did studies in bubbles and you're actually able to interview people from these bubbles, they would all have a similar opinion. And again, obviously, we haven't learned from Edmund. Those who don't know history are destined to repeat it. Today, where are we today? The leverage ratio today in a lot of the major banks is between 10 to 12 to 1. You look at Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is running about 11.8 to 1. I read an article today in Bloomberg that one of the analysts is saying they should increase their leverage ratio, which I thought was fairly interesting. Their ROE is 11.5%. In 2007, Goldman Sachs' ROE was 32%. Look at the impact a decreased amount of leverage has on their profitability. Capital's tougher to get. Anybody that's tried to go out and buy a car, a house, obviously, you need more skin in the game, which is good. But capital is tougher. Capital is tougher for businesses. Competitive landscape has changed within the market. You have less banks. And I think that's a positive thing, not that we have less banks, that the overall fierceness of the competition has changed. When we were involved in 2007, especially toward the end, we were involved in making prices on that. If you go back to the security market line, we were pricing risk incorrectly, not because we wanted to, but because we had to do business. The environment is much different today. Increased regulation is very necessary. Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act is a good thing. I'm not as big a fan of the Volcker Rule. Proprietary trading is not what caused the financial crisis. It's a big number. $10 trillion of debt or of household net worth is gone. That number came from the Financial Crisis Commission. Moral hazard and too big to fail remain. What have we done? We've consolidated banks. We've made banks bigger. Instead of actually spreading out risk, we've consolidated risk. Moral hazard, as we think about this, who do we save, who don't we save? The U.S. The U.S. is dealing with twin deficits. The credit default spread is increasing. I think it's very interesting, it's positive that over the last week, you've had Ryan come out with his budget plan, and Obama's addressing, the president's addressing it. That's a positive step towards solving our deficit. We need to solve that as we go forward. And I think the interesting thing to me is the focus has changed to the pigs. And what do I mean by this? Corporate balance sheets are the healthiest they've been in 20 years. You're seeing the banks recover. M&A activity is increasing. And what does that tell us when M&A activity is increasing? Banks have built up a huge hoard of cash. They're spending it. What they're telling us is that that's actually, they're seeing, their see-through to their industry is positive. They're investing cash. On the flip side, it's taken 2 years, but the pigs and us, if you, pugs, if you add us there, it's catching up. Countries now are facing issues. They have to make tough choices. As you think about why, if you ask yourself, why are the corporations in good health? Let me see. They cut workers. They cut costs. They close businesses. Countries are basically doing the same thing now, and they have to making tough choices about how do we live within our means. And again, we're gonna, in the U.S., we're going to have that difficult discussion. That's coming. That's it. Great question. I've asked myself that question quite often. I had exposure to Lehman, so I definitely wanted to say. The reason that they gave was that they did not have a bylaw, they could not do it. And what happened with Bear Stearns, what happened with Merrill Lynch, is they arranged a purchase of the bank. And they basically said they did not have the authority by law to use taxpayers' money to save the bank. I think that is at times a spurious argument. I think it was, you just had Bear Stearns, you had Fannie Mae, you had AIG. The public wasn't in the mood for saving Lehman. And I think they were caught in between a situation where they'd already spent money, for the political will wasn't there to save them. They used the reason that they couldn't do it from a legal standpoint. I think that's part of it, but I think more like a big reason was there wasn't a lot of political appetite to do that.
Does BP increase faster the higher the level it is? Because like you said, the U.S. is around like 68 or something like that. For nations that have a higher BP, does it tend to increase faster the higher it is?
Higher what? Excuse me?
The higher level the BP is, does it tend to increase faster when it gets up to that point? Is it just...
BP mean?
The rate of increasing, like, does it exponentially...
Now, what the credit default spread and how they, the basis points, how they change, it's driven by the market. So it's a market perception of the risk. So what happens, and this is what happened in 2007, they were trading the credit default spreads as not as a insurance, they were trading directionally. So if you're negative on Lehman Brothers, you would buy credit default spreads. And as you buy it, it would push up a lot of supply and demand. As you have more buyer, it pushes that default spread up. There's informational content in that. Right? If you see a huge spike in the credit default swaps in a certain company, that's basically could tell you, that the market has either doesn't trust Greece, that they don't think Greece is as if the credit default swap in Greece is trading above 1,000, they don't believe what the Greeks are saying about their ability to restructure or to make it. Right, so there is information. It's not linear. It's a function of market supply and demand.
What do you think about the current market's health? I know that the bull market just turned two pretty recently. I've also heard rumors and issues that the government is no longer propping it up. What do you think about its health in the coming months and the next year?
U.S. or overall?
Uh,
I think we had a great run. From the bottom of 2009, the markets had a great run. I think there's a lot of headwinds out there. What happens with oil? You're seeing the revolts you're seeing and the turmoil in the Middle East is going to drive oil price. That's going to be an issue going forward. Does it come back? Growth depends on growth. Have we stabilized? Are we continuing to grow? So if oil prices subsides, some of that issue goes away. If you see the GDP increase, I think you still have some room for some upside. But I think you do have a lot of issues out there right now that are providing a headwind. And I don't think you're going to get a clear picture on direction for, I think, for the foreseeable future, three, 4, 5, 6 months.
You talked a little bit about the Federal Reserve and their response to the crisis. I'm mm-hmm. wondering if you could comment more on that, particularly their more recent response with quantitative easing.
Well, it depends on what side of the fence you're on, if you believe in quantitative easing or if you don't believe in quantitative easing. The Fed is in charge of the monetary policy. Obviously, if you can't lower rates, or the Federal Reserve rate right now, if Fed funds rate is 0 to 0.25%, you can't go lower than that. So one of their methods of impacting policy now is QE2. QE2 is over. I mean, there's one of the reasons that they believe that the PIMCO is shorting now, he's shorting U.S. Treasuries, is the belief that after QE2, the support for the bond market is going to fall. So, again, it's depending if you think that that's necessary for the Fed to buy bonds to put money increase the money supply, if that's necessary to grow the economy, then you're a fan of QE2. If you think we should stop, because somebody has to pay for it. I don't know how many people know what QE2 is, but brief definition. QE2 is quantitative easing. And what that means is the Fed goes out and buys bonds from the market, and they take the bonds from the market participants and they give them money. Where does that money come from? Yeah, basically, it's that little gremlin guy in the basement turning the money wheel. They're creating money, right? So again, I'm more of the opinion that we should get rid of QE2 and let the market sort itself out right now. Yes, sir.
What's the dollar going to do? Is it going to remain stable, strengthen, or weaken?
It depends on you. What you believe we're going to do with our deficit. Are we going to address that issue? There's a lot of different views with regard to what impacts the FX rate or the foreign currency rate. One of them is money supply. We're increasing money supply. The value of our dollar is going down. We're actively doing that. So I think that if we make an interest rate differential also, inflation drives interest rates or FX rates. Interest rate differential is also a driver. If you look at some of the other economies out there, the EU just or EC just raised interest rates from 1% to 1.25%. They've also said they'll probably do it again in June. So the differential is growing. That's going to have a negative impact on the FX rate. So I think near term, I don't really see the dollar rally against our major trading partners.
I just want to hear your personal opinion on, because a lot of people are pretty mad when we bailed out certain banks, but we also, like you said, have the risk of letting those things fail in the economy or the moral hazard. What do you think was the right decision to do? Should we have let those banks fail and let the economy face those crashes, or should we not endorse moral
hazard? That's a very good question. It depends on how much of a capitalist you are. If you are a capitalist, you believe that firms should fail, and the process of failing gets rid of the weak and poorly managed corporations, and that will help the market be healthier. The question is, how much would we be willing to suffer through that? The reason the Fed and the government react the way they did was the thought that we could have a financial meltdown. So the question is, where do you stand? For me, I wish that they would have saved Lehman and let Merrill fall. So, more importantly, I think that's a very tough question, and that brings a lot of issues in play. We should have regulated them a lot better. Hindsight's 20/20, but we should have done a much better job of, on the back end, preventing that from happening.
What's the, I guess, the short-term and the long-term effect of this $300 billion tsunami and earthquake in Japan to the world economy and to the U.S. in general?
Well, it should decrease, should have an impact. You'd have to ask probably Rich Schatz in the background, an economist, probably have a much better answer than I would, but it's going to impact GDP, probably worldwide GDP. Obviously going to have. If you look at what happened in Japan and the end of the 90s, they didn't restructure their bank debt. They're carrying a lot of debt on their books. They haven't had any growth per se. They have a very high deficit. It will definitely impact Japan's growth and potentially impact trading partners with Japan. So I think it's a negative impact for Japan. Again, how big that will be is not clear, but it will definitely have an impact on a very negative impact on Japan. Go forth.
What's your perspective on how do you feel the world sees the U.S. economy solidity?
I know that before I left Europe, Europeans thought we were the laughing stock of most of the rest of the world. I don't think that opinion has really changed. I don't think they still hold us to very high regard. Part of that was because of Bush. They were very negative on him and how he ran the economy, or the U.S. and the foreign policy. I think with the financial crisis, they still will probably blame the U.S. So I think the overall impression of the U.S., I think Obama has had a positive impact on how the world perceives us. But I think overall, still, we have the jury's out. And I can only speak from Europe. I can't speak from Asia, but my experience in Europe is such that they still not a huge fan of us. That answer that?
The effect on the dollar being the world economy's foundation now, that seems to be changing to a non-fiat currency.
Yeah, well, there's a huge... If you listen to talk radio, they believe we should go back to the gold standard. But we left the gold standard for a reason. You listen to some of these guys, and they want you to dig a big hole in the backyard and put all your assets in it. I think that the answer to that is things change, and our roles is the reserve currency. That could change. Obviously, part of it's political. The Chinese don't want to see it. The Chinese would rather have a, similar to what the World Bank has, the special drawing rights, SDRs. But I think that's open. If we don't get our house in order, yeah, we could see more money going to the euro. They could try to create a different currency. I think fiat currency is here to stay. I don't see that changing.
I've got a last quick question. As you're working in these banks, could you talk about, as you see the bubbles starting to emerge, what did you think about them or think about what your company should be doing?
Well, if you look at and I took a slide out. I took a couple slides out. One of the slides I had in was what did we see? And if you think about an investment bank are run by division. And they're fairly insulated silo in that business. And the investment banks in the different divisions, so you have fixed income division, you have the equity division, you have the investment banking division, they all use different amounts of capital. They all use different leverage ratios. Obviously, the fixed income side of the shop uses a lot more capital than we are just because of the size of the market. Not necessarily more profitable all the time, but they use more capital to generate that profit. And our side, we don't have a lot of exposure into their positions. What we did see, and I was talking about the proprietary trader, when we sat there and watched 2005, we would have a risk meeting every week. This trader had been short from end of 2005 all the way through 2007 against, he was basically selling consumer stocks. And his view was, they can't stand up. And we talked a lot about that. So did we see part of it coming? We believe that the consumer was going to roll over at some point in time, that they couldn't keep spending like they were. Did we think what happened was going to happen? No. I'm one of those that, yeah, there were not good signs happening in 2006, 2007. You wouldn't want to be loading up on equities. But what Taleb said about a black swan, it might be a gray swan. It wasn't out 6-7 standard deviation from what you thought. People within the fixed income market that did a lot of research on CDOs, they knew it was coming. There's a lot of people. Paulson, the hedge fund manager, made $6-7 billion by shorting CDOs, basically buying CDS swaps. So part of the market had a good idea. I think the issue was it didn't take a lot to realize that a leverage ratio, it didn't take much to get us in trouble.
Again, please join me in thanking Dell. Again, our last lecture in the series will be on May 5th, week right before finals. If you're visiting and need a signature, you can come up and get that from me. If you'd like, you can come up and talk with Duff, ask any questions as well.